Hi, everyone, and welcome to our fifth session on the life of Menachem Begin, Israel's sixth prime minister. And once again, we're calling him Israel's Jewish prime minister. Obviously, all of Israel's prime ministers have been Jewish, but we're kind of looking specifically at what made him a unique prime minister and the role of Jewishness played in that. Just to review very quickly, we did in our first session a brief review of the period between his birth in Brisk and his arrival in Palestine at the age of 29 in the spring of 1942. Then we did a session on the period between his arrival and the declaration of Israel's independence, which mostly covered the revolt and his being in the underground, hiding from the British. Then we did something on the two major incidences right around Israel's independence, the Deir Yassin incident, commonly called the Deir Yassin massacre, but we tried to make it clear that that's much less clear these days, and the event of the Altalena, which was a very short-lived civil war in Israel in the early days of the Israeli state. Then last time we talked about the years in the opposition, which are commonly skipped over when one thinks about Begin, but there were really important events there. What we learned about the Soblin experience, his attitude to military rule over the Arabs, his attitude to even Ben-Gurion during the Six-Day War, and finally the Mahapach, that strange word that was invented by Yavin that night of the election in 1977, the overturning or the revolution or the upending, however you want to call it. Next time, which will be our last segment, we'll look at the Lebanon War, which he will start after the events of that we're going to cover today, his resignation in the middle of the Lebanon War, and then almost a decade of isolation. And we'll talk a little bit about why he seems to have isolated himself. And then we'll try to recapture altogether what it was that led to what I call his biblical statesmanship. Today we want to look at three incidences, two of them a little bit more briefly and one of them at somewhat greater length. The first one will be the incident of the Vietnamese boat people, which took place almost immediately after he was elected. Then we'll spend the majority of time talking about the peace arrangement, the peace treaty with Egypt and his relationship with Anwar Sadat and Jimmy Carter. And then finally, we'll say a little bit about the attack on OC Iraq in June of 1981 and the destruction of Iraq's nuclear reactor. Almost as soon as Begin is elected in the spring of 1977, word reaches Israel that an Israeli freighter named the Uvali, which was in the South China Sea, had come across 66 Vietnamese refugees who were fleeing the war in Vietnam and found themselves on some sort of boat, all out of food, completely out of food, and essentially out of water. They were giving children 3 teaspoons of water each a day, and there was no water for any of the adults. Ships of all different sorts of nationalities had passed by, had definitely seen them, and had not stopped. Interestingly, and not surprisingly, quite frankly, the Uvali stopped, took them on board, radioed back to Israel and said, "What do we do?" And Menachem Begin said, "Bring them to Israel." They were obviously in terrible medical condition, and they needed to try to get them some kind of hospitalization or at least some infusions or whatever. But also, not surprisingly, tragically, Japan, Hong Kong, Taiwan, among others, refused to allow them to come ashore, even temporarily. The Israelis made guarantees that this was going to be very short-lived, just to give them the emergency treatment that they needed. But none of those countries would allow them to step foot on the shore. Medical equipment was brought onto the Uvali, and ultimately these people came back to Israel. And Begin made them full citizens, gave them certain amount of financial assistance. Many of them still live in Israel. One became a well-known Israeli poet. It's quite an extraordinary story. In July 1977, which is a month later, when Carter and Begin meet for the first time as in his role as prime minister, Carter actually congratulated him for what he had done with the Vietnamese refugees. The relationship between Carter and Begin is going to go very far south after this when we get to the negotiations with Egypt. But at that point, it was at least fairly cordial. And it's important to note what Begin said in response to Carter's compliment. Begin said, and here I'm quoting the translation, "We had never forgotten the lot of our people, persecuted, humiliated, ultimately physically destroyed. Therefore, it was natural that my first act as prime minister was to give those people a haven in the land of Israel." And once again, here is Menachem Begin tying his decisions, tying his instincts, tying his morality and his whole ethical compass to his experience as a Jew and to his sense, really, that the state of Israel was an extension of the biblical narrative. This was really liberalism at its core. And again, we've been distinguishing between the way in which the word liberalism is commonly used as kind of left of center or left leaning, which of course is not what liberalism means at all. And here it was liberalism really at its very best, the value of the individual, the dignity of human beings. And for Begin, it really didn't make any difference in this case whether they were Jewish or non-Jewish. They were human, and that was all that matters. Without getting into the issue of Israeli politics today or Israeli personalities today, when Benny Begin makes comments, which he does periodically, about the way in which the Likud has changed between the days of his father's leadership of the Likud and what the Likud is in the first part of the 21st century, you can see, without getting into the nitty-gritty of Israeli politics, how different is the attitude towards refugees, even in Israel today. Now, to be sure, we're talking about 66 people in danger of imminent death on the South China Sea, as opposed to many tens of thousands who've left, who entered Israel illegally. There's no question that the situations are radically different, but nonetheless, the instinct about how to react to these people was really very unique under Begin. A few months after that meeting between Carter and Begin, which took place in July of 1977, Anwar Sadat gets up in Egypt and he addresses his parliament and says to them, after a whole array of introductory words, and he says, "You," and here I'm going to quote, "you will be stunned to hear me tell you that I am ready to go to the ends of the earth, even to their home, to the Knesset itself, to argue with them in order to prevent one Egyptian soldier from being wounded." That was the way in which the world heard for the first time that Anwar Sadat, the president of Egypt, the heir of Nasser, the leader of the most powerful militarily, economically, historically, even Arab nation on the planet, was willing to recognize Israel's existence. If you're going to go to the Knesset, you're obviously recognizing the existence of Israel, and to begin some kind of a conversation about reaching an end to the state of war between them. Now, this was in a lot of ways a very surprising move, and in a lot of ways, though, a not surprising move. As my colleague at Shalem College, Martin Kramer, pointed out in a lecture that he did not long ago for the Tikva Fund, there were actually some similarities between Begin and Sadat that not everyone points to sufficiently, and I think Professor Kramer did an extraordinary job of pointing to them. Strangely enough, Sadat was a Nazi sympathizer, which would make him seem, in a certain level, somebody entirely unable to get along with Begin, whose family had been destroyed by the Nazis. But there were also similarities. Begin had spent time in prison for his resistance against the British, and Sadat had spent time in prison because of his resistance of the British. Begin and Sadat, while they sought different avenues to get rid of the British, one from Palestine and one from Egypt, both detested the British, and saw that it was their role in life, to a certain extent, to liberate their country from the grips of that occupying power. So in a certain way, it was surprising because they were so different. In a certain way, it wasn't surprising because there were certain similarities. But people who were in the know, who understood what was going on behind the scenes, knew that something had been cooking for a while, even prior to Sadat's public announcement. Begin had been in touch with Romania's ruler, Nicolae Ceaușescu. Ceaușescu had a good relationship with Sadat. Begin felt that Ceaușescu might be a good intermediary with Sadat and apparently let it be known that he would be open to having a conversation with Sadat about a cessation of hostilities. And Begin also sent Moshe Dayan. Moshe Dayan, the Labor Party minister, Moshe Dayan, the dove, sent him to Morocco to meet with King Hassan to make a similar point. And these people both told Sadat, King Hassan and Ceaușescu both told Sadat, "Listen, Begin is a very tough guy. It is not going to be easy to negotiate with him. He is going to be a stickler for every detail, but he's also a man of his word. If you can reach an arrangement with him, which is by no means guaranteed, the arrangement will stick." So that's why Sadat, at the end of the day, on November 9th, 1977, gets up and announces to his parliament, by the way, Yasser Arafat, quite ironically, was sitting in the audience that day. So he learned that way, that this was about to happen. 2 days later, Menachem Begin, on November 11th, gives a radio broadcast in Israel, and through that broadcast invites Sadat to come to Jerusalem. And 2 days after that, Sadat accepted. Sadat wanted to come on a Saturday. Begin was perfectly willing to have him come on a Saturday, but not on Shabbat. So they actually agreed that he would come at 8 p.m. on a November. 8 p.m. is after Shabbat. And the festivities that many people have now seen on YouTube and many other kinds of documentaries then unfolded. It was actually a little bit surreal because part of this is actually not very well known. What was seen by the public were the parading troops, the military bands, the Israeli flags, and the Egyptian flags flying side by side in Tel Aviv, or at the Lod airport more specifically. What many people did not know was that there were a number of Israelis in the security apparatus who really didn't believe that Sadat could be serious about this. And they imagined that the Egyptians were counting on all of the Israeli top political echelon and the military brass all gathering together at the bottom of the stairway from the plane where the red carpet would be. And then they imagined that it was possible that the door would spring open and Egyptian commandos would come bursting out of the plane and mow down whoever they could among the Israelis. Most Israelis weren't worried about that, but some very serious people actually were. So in addition to the flags and the pomp and circumstance and the bands and all of that, there was actually a whole array of Israeli sharpshooters lying on the top of the roof of the airport, the old British-built terminal before Israel built its new airport, with their scopes trained exactly on the door that would open. Thankfully, of course, they didn't need to use them. And then when Sadat comes down the stairs, he first meets Menachem Begin, and they shake hands. You can see in the photographs and in the videos, it's a bit of an awkward handshake. Israel and Egypt had been at war not that long ago. Of course, Begin wasn't prime minister then, but still, it was awkward. And I think they both must have understood that if this was going to get serious, this was going to be the determining event in both of their lives. And there was a kind of awkwardness and heaviness about it that day. But at that moment, at that very moment at the bottom of the stairs, Sadat also met Dayan. He met Yitzhak Rabin, he met Golda Meir, he met all of the people who had led Israel when Israel had defeated Egypt in 1947, in 1956, in 1967, and to a certain extent in 1973 as well. If I can take just a moment to take a sidestep from our historical narrative and just share with you a personal memory of that Saturday when Begin met Sadat at the foot of the airplane in November 1977. It was, as I said, a Shabbat, and I did not and do not use electricity on Shabbat, but my grandparents lived on the Upper West Side, and I was a student at Columbia back then, and they did use electricity on Shabbat, and I knew that my grandparents would be watching it, and I decided that I would walk down to 66th Street from Columbia, walk up the 24 flights, because there was no TVs in the public areas of my dorm at Columbia, and that was my best chance to watch this thing. And my grandfather, who in his day was a very well-known biblical scholar and one of the leading rabbis in the American Jewish community, was also a very big physical presence, tall and broad. And I go up there and we're watching this thing in the middle of the day, about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, obviously, in New York time, if it was 8 o'clock p.m. Israel time. And we're watching this. And we're watching it on one of those old televisions, a big console, and the door opens up of the plane. And you can see Sadat coming down the stairs, and you can see there's a crowd of people, but even then, you could see him being greeted by all of these Israelis. And then they played HaTikvah. And you see Sadat standing at attention for the Israeli national anthem. And as we're watching this, I all of a sudden heard some sound that I couldn't quite place what it was. It didn't seem to be coming from the living room, from the TV, but it was only me and my grandmother and my grandfather sitting in the living room of their apartment in Lincoln Center, and I just couldn't figure out where this sound was coming from. And I'm looking left and right trying to see, and all of a sudden I look at my grandfather, who's sitting next to me to my left on the sofa, and he's wearing a blue shirt, actually not that different from the shirt that I'm wearing now, and the shirt is entirely soaked with tears. He was sobbing. It was one of the only two times in my entire life that I saw my grandfather cry. And I realized then that was 1977. He was born in 1908, so he was 69 years old. He had been a rabbi in America during the Shoah. It had been hard to imagine in those years of 42, 43, 44, 45, in the terrible years of 47 and 48, in all of those wars between 48 and 56 and 67 and 70 and 73, it had been hard to imagine that he would ever actually live to see the leader of Egypt, of his own accord, standing in what was essentially Greater Tel Aviv, standing at attention in great respect for the Israeli national anthem. And whenever I think of Begin and Sadat and Carter and this whole thing, I have this image of my grandfather, and it reminds me of, even though many of us now are so used to this because decades and decades have gone by, we take it for granted that the peace happened, it was not at all obvious just a couple days before that it was going to happen. And I try to remember that moment of seeing my grandfather's shirt soaked with his tears to remind myself how really unanticipable this whole thing really was. Sadat, after he comes to Tel Aviv, he's taken to Jerusalem, of course. He goes to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which would be expected, and then eventually addresses the Knesset. And in his speech at the Knesset, he lays out five conditions for peace. The first was a return to the 1967 borders. Again, important for us to remember that the 1967 borders are really the 1949 armistice borders. They are the borders that not one single Arab country had agreed to. It was just where the fighting happened to stop. And no Arab country recognized those lines as Israel's borders in any way, shape, manner, or form. By 1967 and then later in the 70s, everybody wants to go back to the 67 borders. So all of a sudden, the 67 borders become sacrosanct in some kind of a way. It's important to remember that they did not start out that way. So the first is a return to the 67 lines. The second is independence for the Palestinians, which he left entirely undefined, but he did say that he wanted that. And the other three were kind of just, you know, window dressing. A right for all to live in peace and security, a commitment not to resort to arms in the future, and an end of belligerency in the Middle East. Begin, of course, did not do any of his negotiating about the issues in his address at that moment, but he did follow Sadat and speaking, and he gave a lecture which is worth hearing. It's available widely online, which was laced with biblical references. And it's very important for us to understand that when Begin now digs deep into the Bible as he responds to Sadat, of course, in Hebrew, he is responding in a sense that this is a continuation of the biblical story. This third commonwealth, so to speak, is a continuation of the story of the first temple and the second temple, and the peace treaties that various Israelite kings made with the nations around them is part of the story of the first kings and so forth in the Bible, first and second kings. This is now a story that, as far as Begin is concerned, is a continuation of that narrative. So he quotes the Bible left and right. He says, Chesed ve'emet nifgashu, tzedek v'shalom nashaku, righteousness and peace have kissed and met up. And he uses a phrase from Zechariah, which he just quotes very briefly. He says, v'ha'emet v'ha'ashalom ehavu. You should love honesty and integrity. Now, one could think, okay, well, that's a very beautiful phrase, and he's saying to the Egyptian president, as we get to this business of negotiating, we should both love honesty and integrity. But I want to suggest that I think, though I've never seen anybody really write very much about this, that it was actually a code which Begin understood that his religious listeners would understand. Because the whole verse that's there in the book of Zechariah is, Ko amar Hashem tzvot tzom harvi'i, V'tzom ha-chamishi, v'tzom ha-shvi'i, v'tzom ha-asiri, yiyeh levet Yehuda l'sason ul'simcha ul'moadim tovim, v'ha-emet v'ha-shalom ehavu. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the fast of the fourth month, and the fast of the fifth month, and the fast of the seventh month, and the fast of the tenth month, all of these will become occasions for joy and gladness, happy festivals for the house of Judah. But you must love honesty and integrity. What Begin, I think, is reminding his listeners who were brought up in the religious world who knew the biblical reference was, even though he says, I'm only quoting that little part about loving honesty and integrity, that's part of a verse that says that sad days can be turned into joyous days, that days of mourning can be turned into days of celebration. Gird yourselves for difficult decisions, because what we're about to do is what the prophet Zechariah himself said would be possible. Now, the negotiations, not surprisingly, were exhausting, frustrating, infuriating for many of the parties. The Americans tried to serve as intermediaries, not terribly successfully, but they did. And they came to the conclusion very quickly that Sadat and Begin saw the world very, very differently. To them, Sadat saw this grand vision of a brand new Middle East. He was a big picture guy. And every time they got into negotiations, Begin, the lawyer, don't forget that Begin sardonically reminded Ben-Gurion in the Soblin's affair that he had finished law school, that Ben-Gurion had not finished law school. And Begin, the lawyer, was nitpicking every single little detail, infuriating not only Sadat, but the Americans as well. Jimmy Carter actually remarked at one point that he thought that Begin was like a Pharisee. This was the classic Pharisaic legalistic trap. He didn't quite say it this bluntly, that the Jews always fell into. But Begin didn't really care what anybody thought. This was a huge issue for Israel, and he was going to negotiate it as carefully as he needed to. The main sticking point at the beginning was Palestinian autonomy, which for Begin was a complete non-starter. There was simply nothing to discuss here at all. And we need to remember that for some of our listeners today, that may seem a bit extreme. I mean, really, you're not willing to discuss it at all? It's important to remember that more than four decades have gone by since then, and the world is a very different place today. Not that many years prior to that, Golda Meir, the left, the Labor Party, the beloved international figure, when asked what she thought about the future of the Palestinian people, said, "Eze am Palestinai? What Palestinian people are you even talking about?" In other words, it was a very different world. So for an Israeli prime minister to say it's a non-starter, there's nothing to talk about, may seem a little bit crazy today, because after all, even Likud members today, of the leaders of the government today from Likud, have said that they favor a two-state solution. Sometimes people believe them, sometimes they don't, but that's another issue altogether. It was a very different world back then. When I was interviewing Yechiel Kadishai, Begin's right-hand man, for writing my biography, Kadishai passed away not that long afterwards, I asked him, though, when they were talking about this whole Palestinian autonomy issue, what did they actually mean? I mean, was it something like the Palestinian Authority that we came to know? Was it something like a Palestinian state that people were demanding across the world? When they spoke, yes, autonomy, no autonomy, what were they actually talking about? And Kadishai kind of smiled and he said, nobody had any idea what they were talking about. But it didn't really matter, because it was so clear that it was a non-starter, there was no point spending time on defining what was never going to happen. But people say, you know, Begin and Sadat already talked about a Palestinian state back then. Not true. People say Begin and Sadat already spoke about some sort of Palestinian authority or autonomy back then. Not really true. Sadat brought it up, Begin put the kibosh on it, but it was a very, very bitter and long-standing discussion between them for a very long time. Another issue, not surprisingly, was the settlement project. Begin absolutely refused the demands of both the Americans and the Egyptians that Israel cease building on the West Bank. He said, absolutely not. It's our land. God gave it to us. We're going to keep building. Now, therefore, it's also tempting to say, so Begin would have been in favor of annexation, obviously. That, again, I think would be a historical mistake. It would be anachronistic to do that. Begin did not do anything to annex the West Bank in the years that he was prime minister. Now, you can say he would have liked to, but he couldn't because of realpolitik, maybe, but there's really no way to know. And I was working on the biography of Begin at exactly the same time that Barack Obama was trying to get Bibi Netanyahu to impose a building freeze on the West Bank so they could get the Palestinians to come back to the table. You may recall that at the end, after a tremendous amount of pressure, Netanyahu did agree to a building freeze for a certain period of time, and the Palestinians still didn't come back to the table. But at my last meeting, I believe, with Kadishai, it was when Bibi was being pressured to agree to that. And we were kind of wrapping up our meeting. I, of course, didn't know it would be the last time that I would see him. And I said to him, vis-a-vis the news, you know, what if Begin was prime minister today and the American president was pressuring him to stop building in the West Bank? What would he do? And Kadishai was still full of fire, even at the very end of his life. And I was expecting him to say, are you kidding me? Menachem Begin agreed to a cessation of building the settlements. And he looked at me, and he was quiet for a minute, and then he said, "La'agid lecha et ha'emet, en li musag." To tell you the truth, I have absolutely no idea. And I think that actually speaks an enormous, speaks really profoundly about Begin's unpredictability in the best sense of the word. Unpredictability in the sense that his question always was, "What's the best thing for the Jewish people?" And we'll see this come up again in 1982 with the Lebanon War in a very different kind of a way. But it's very hard to predict what Menachem Begin will do. We'll talk at the end of today about his attack on Osirak. Here's the man who's going to get shortly the Nobel Peace Prize, who's then going to go out and attack a country that doesn't even abut Israel. His question always was, what's good for the Jewish people? And therefore, Kadishai said, really hard to know what Begin would have done under Obama's pressure. I think that was to Kadishai's credit and to Begin's to recognize that it's very easy to say what would have happened, but really impossible to know. But by the way, when it came to going back to the 1967 lines, Begin was not the only one who was completely opposed to it. Even Moshe Dayan, the dove from the Labor Party, who was a bit involved in these conversations, told Sadat, that the 1967 lines have for us something of the memory of Auschwitz. That was Dayan's lines. Dayan was born in Degania, right? He had no personal memory of Auschwitz, and his parents were in Palestine long before. But still, Auschwitz held for him a certain kind of sense of simple Jewish indefensibility, the idea of utter Jewish powerlessness and exposure. And Dayan said to Sadat, those lines, that's what it means for us. It's really not going to happen. It's also important to point out that not only were Begin and Sadat haggling over all of these issues, and we haven't even come to the Sinai yet, Begin was experiencing tremendous pushback in his own party, because it was very clear to everyone, no matter where the negotiations were, the Sinai was going to be the big issue. Sadat had not come to Israel at the beginning to sign over the Sinai to Israel in exchange for a peace agreement. That was clearly not going to happen. And when Menachem Begin extended to him the invitation to come on November 11, 77, Menachem Begin had to know that that was going to be the issue, and he also had to understand that there was no way Sadat was going to sign something and go home empty-handed. But there were people in the Likud who thought that the idea of giving back an area like the Sinai, of strategic importance, of such enormous size, and so on and so forth, was unthinkable. And Shmuel Katz, who incidentally had been in the Paris office of the Etzel during the whole Altalena incident, but had become a part of the Likud party, very important during those years, thought that it was outrageous. And when Begin said to him, but according to the Tanakh, according to the Bible, Sinai is not actually part of Eretz Yisrael, Katz blew his stack at Begin and said, don't quote me the Bible. You can prove anything you want with the Bible. It's wrong to give back the Sinai. Begin saw that as an act of ultimate disloyalty, and for all intents and purposes after that conversation, the two men never spoke again, even though they would live for quite a bit of time. So the negotiations are going on. The Americans are trying to help out. Things are not moving. And by the end of 1977, December 26th to be exact, they meet in Isma'iliya, which, by the way, if you may remember, was the town where Kadi Shai had been stationed when he was part of the Jewish Brigade for the British. They reach an utter impasse. Begin is also failing health-wise at this point. Without going into all of the details of what he was dealing with, he had a heart condition, he had a variety of other conditions. Many people thought they saw him losing focus in meetings. It wasn't really clear that he entirely understood. Tremendous debates to this day among those who are still alive who knew him then, to what extent he was focused, wasn't focused, and it's really very hard to know. Carter understands, though, or at least thinks, that time is running out, and he therefore decides to throw a Hail Mary pass, and he asks that everybody meet together in Camp David outside Washington, D.C., for 12 days of negotiations. Begin is very much not interested, but because of a variety of reasons, it gets delayed, but ultimately they all do meet up in September of 1978. So it's a good number of months later, but 9 months later, they all meet up in Camp David. And Begin's team that comes with him is very impressed. Camp David is beautiful. I've never been there, but you can see pictures. It's very foresty and beautiful and pastoral. And one of Begin's entourage said to him, look, it's pretty beautiful here, isn't it? And he is reputed to have said back, concentration camp deluxe. Meaning at the end of the day, what they're going to try to do here is do us in. It's just a little prettier than the ones that we've heard about in Europe. Obviously a bit of an exaggeration, but it does give you a little bit of an insight into what Begin's mood was at that point. Sadat now comes to Camp David with two additional requirements that he had really not put on the table in any meaningful way prior. One was that Israel withdraw from the West Bank, to make possible a future Palestinian state, and that Israel compensate Egypt for the damages it had suffered in the 1973 war. Now, that one's, of course, completely ludicrous, since it was Sadat himself who had started the war. But they were both complete non-starters. Most people who try to understand what Sadat was probably doing here was trying to save face in the Arab world. He had had enough time since the beginning of those negotiations to see how furious the rest of the Arab world was with him, to see how he had become the most reviled leader anywhere in the Arab world. And he might have been trying to actually buy back a little bit of territory, even if he couldn't get those things, to at least request them and to defend his reputation a little bit. But the arguments become so heated that Carter decides after 2 days, they were supposed to be there for 12, Carter decides after 2 days, these two men, Begin and Sadat, are not going to see each other here at all. They're going to be kept in entirely different places, and the Americans would do the back and forth negotiations. The American ambassador to Israel, Sam Lewis, thought that Begin was utterly confused, that he was bewildered, that he couldn't understand what was going on, whereas Cyrus Vance, who was the Secretary of State, saw exactly the same meetings and responded to people that Begin was probably the best poker player he had ever seen. So there were two radically different interpretations of what this man was doing. Carter had completely lost patience with Begin and actually went back one day and told Rosalind, his wife, Begin is a psycho, he said. Begin and Carter never got along again after that. Begin, I think, felt about Carter the way Carter felt about Begin. One last point that I'll make quickly before we go on to one issue about dividing Jerusalem, which is that Carter, ironically, seems never to have really understood that, unlike Sadat, Begin had to sell whatever deal he came up with back to the Knesset. He was the head of a democracy, and you would think that Jimmy Carter, who had a deal with Congress, would have understood that. Sadat could do whatever he wanted. He had to try to stay alive afterwards, but he could make whatever deal he wanted. Menachem Begin had, in addition to everything else, keep in mind, how is his own party going to respond? How's the Knesset going to respond? How's the Israeli people going to respond? Carter seemed to have no interest whatsoever in making that a consideration when he thought about Begin. Now, because we're focusing on Begin's Jewishness in all of this, it's important to tell one story about how Begin responded to Sadat when it came to the issue of dividing Jerusalem between East and West. Obviously, Jerusalem had been divided until 67, but Israel had captured the old city and East Jerusalem in 67 and had never talked about giving it back. Even when there was debate about the other parts of the territories that had been captured, Jerusalem was never discussed. And Sadat wanted to raise it. And Carter wanted him to talk about it, and Carter asks Begin to at least have a conversation about it. And here Begin tells Carter, who again was very unsympathetic to Begin most of the time, he told him the story of Rabbi Amnon of Mainz. Rabbi Amnon of Mainz was a medieval figure who was asked by, or told, or commanded by the Archbishop of Mainz to convert to Christianity. And as Jewish legend has it, Rabbi Amnon said to the Archbishop, "Please give me 3 days to think about it." And after 3 days, he goes back and he says, of course, he's not going to convert to Christianity. And then he is tortured, his arms are cut off, his legs are cut off. And it's as he's dying and as his soul is about to depart, his body has the tradition that he recited Unetana Tokef, the very famous prayer piyut from the High Holidays liturgy. But basically, Rami Amnon had said to the Archbishop that he had sinned by saying that he even needed 3 days to consider whether or not he was going to convert to Christianity. That was his sin, as far as Rabbi Amnon was concerned about himself. And Begin said, "I'm not going to make the mistake that Rabbi Amnon of Mainz made. I'm not going to even pretend to think about whether or not we can have a conversation about Jerusalem. We can't." And here, Carter's Christian faith actually did come in. There was something about the way Begin told the story that got through to Carter. There were certain matters of faith that are entirely not negotiable. They're not territory, they're not politics, they're not tit for tat. Carter understood it somehow and let the whole thing drop. The one last issue that they debated about a lot was that Begin wanted to keep the Jewish settlements in the Sinai that had been built. Yamit is the most famous one, but it wasn't the only one. Begin wanted to keep these settlements intact, even if the Sinai did go back to Egypt. Sadat said, "Absolutely not. It's not possible." And I personally never understood what that actually meant, what you would have Yamit buried in the middle of Egypt somewhere. And I asked Kadi Shai, what was Begin actually expecting to happen if they would keep Yamit? How would they, what was it going to be like? And again, Kadi Shai smiled and he said, "It was a fantasy." At this point, when it came to giving back the land, Begin was literally living in a fantasy world, Kadi Shai said, because he wanted to make the deal. But giving back the land was so hard for him that he kind of allowed himself a certain fantasy, which was not, in the end, going to be possible at all. Well, we all know what the compromise was. The compromise was that Egypt recognized Israel, signed a peace treaty with Israel, and Israel, in turn, gave up the Sinai. Egypt, interestingly, by the way, had no interest in getting Gaza back, not surprisingly, but it's worth noting. And Sadat, of course, did what most other Arab leaders have done throughout the last several decades, which is that he gave in on the Palestinian issue without even looking back over his shoulder. It had all been hyperbole, it had all been hype, it had all been for public consumption. Sadat didn't give a hoot about what happened to the Palestinians. He had embarked on the war in 1973 not to destroy Israel, but to restore Egypt's honor. The way to restore Egypt's honor was to get the Sinai back. He had now gotten what he wanted in 1973. The Palestinians just did not figure at all into his calculus. And Begin goes to the Knesset on September 28th, 1978. There is a 17-hour deliberation in the Knesset that ends at 3 a.m., and the Knesset finally votes 84 yes, 19 no, 17 abstentions to accept the deal and to sign a peace treaty with Egypt. Important to recognize, of course, that that peace treaty, despite all the naysayers back then, has held through thick and thin and has made a huge difference in some of Israel's recent wars with Gaza and so forth. Begin and Sadat received the Nobel Peace Prize on December 10th, 1978. Interestingly enough, giving Sadat the Peace Prize was, among the Nobel Committee, not in the least bit controversial. Giving it to Begin was a source of tremendous discord because of Deir Yassin. The fact that Sadat had started the 73 war, which led to the deaths of many thousands of people, did not seem to irk them at all, but Begin's history with Deir Yassin did. But at the end of the day, they decided to offer it to both of them. Equally interestingly, Sadat decided not to go to Oslo to get it. He was worried about his life and his safety. He sent his son-in-law, one could make a certain son-in-law joke about that, but he sent his son-in-law to Oslo to pick up the prize. He himself stayed behind. And the only other thing worth mentioning about the Peace Prize at this particular moment, even though Begin's speech upon its his receiving it was an extraordinary speech that we don't, unfortunately, have time to go into today. Golda Meir was literally in her very last days of life. She actually died while Begin was in Oslo to receive the prize. And one of her last remarks about Begin was that he should have received an Oscar, not a Nobel. And I mention that only because, what was the Oscar? He had really gotten a peace deal. There was no faking anything here. But it's just to show how deep the enmity and the animosity of people in the Labour Party ran for Menachem Begin. I mean, this was a man who had now transformed his image. He had gone from the underground to the opposition 29 years, had stopped the civil war, was now about to be the first leader to sign a peace treaty with an Arab nation, something that the labor governments on the left had never been able to do. And Golda Meir's last lines about Begin at all are the most cynical and derisive. But she was in that regard very much reflective of where most of the Labor Party was. Ben-Gurion, of course, at this time has already passed away. At the very famous signing of the agreement in March 1979 on the White House lawn in front of 1,600 people, Begin famously reaches into his pocket, puts on a black kippah, and without translating anything into English, just recites Shir HaMa'alot, Psalm 126, that we say before Birkat HaMazon, what we say before the grace after meals. And it's interesting to note, by the way, that Shir HaMa'alot, B'shuv Adonai et Shivat Zion, when God restores our fortunes and brings us back to Zion, had been a candidate to be Israel's national anthem. On your own time, you can actually try singing Shir HaMa'alot to the tune of Hatikva, and you'll see that it works perfectly well. But there was a discussion, should it be a psalm or the Hatikva poem, which was written early in the Zionist years? They chose Hatikva, but Begin was actually reciting a poem, a psalm in Hebrew, to make it clear again. This is part of that biblical story. He recites it in Hebrew to say at the end of the day, he was doing what he did as a Jew, and he recites a psalm, when God restores our fortunes and brings us back to Zion, we will be joyous, we will see it as if we were dreamers. And again, I'll just bring you back to that image of my grandfather in November 1977, as if we were dreamers. It really would have been almost unthinkable to imagine that date just a couple of years earlier. In October of 1981, Sadat is, as he worried would be the case, assassinated by his own soldiers, by Muslim radicals within the Egyptian army. There are very famous videos you can see of it. There's a parade, and he's in the grandstands watching the parade, and soldiers jump off the chuck with their live ammunition and run towards where he is sitting. He's mowed down. There's a huge funeral. Begin attends it. The funeral is actually on Shabbat. Begin attends it, Sharon attends it, Yosef Burg attends it, and they all walk several miles from where they were being put up in a hotel to the site of the funeral because it was Shabbat. So again, the last question we ought to ask ourselves before we depart this extraordinary period, about which much more could be said, and of course entire books have been written just about each part of the negotiations, it really is worth asking, who won the 1973 war? One could make an argument, of course, that Israel won the war, because despite the setbacks of the first week or so, the IDF performed admirably and had the Egyptian Third Army completely encircled and have Kissinger not intervened, could have killed the entire Third Army. Israel would never have done it, but could have done so. But by the same token, if Sadat had really had as his intention not to destroy Israel, but to get the Sinai back, he sacrificed many thousands of his own men in doing so, but it actually worked. So the question is, when you ask who won a war, do you mean diplomatically in terms of what were the goals of the war, or do you mean militarily? But what we do know is that after 1973, because of Israel's dramatic turning the course of events around, no standing Arab army ever again attacked the state of Israel. And when Israel signs the peace treaty with Egypt, the Israeli-Arab conflict is over. It's completely over. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not over. Israel has a brewing conflict with the Iranians. But the Israeli-Arab conflict, as we learned to think about it from 48, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Egypt, and so on and so forth, that conflict ends when that signature is done on the south lawn of the White House, just a couple of years after they began the negotiations. Now, I'll just fast forward to 1981, which again, we're in June 1981 now, a few months before Sadat will be killed, but we're on an entirely different issue. And again, if I could just be permitted a brief personal memory of this date. In June 1981, my wife and I were actually on our honeymoon in Hawaii. And we were walking back to our hotel from the beach, and they used to have these machines, you know, you could put a dime or a quarter in and open it up and take out a newspaper, but you could also just look through the glass and see what the headlines were. And we were graduate students without a dime to spare. So we just looked through the glass to see what the news was. And it said, I still remember it vividly, Israel bombs Iraqi nuclear reactor. And we both burst out laughing. And that's so ludicrous. I mean, these Hawaiians will believe anything, it seemed. Of course, in our hotel room, we turned on a relatively new TV station called CNN, and it turns out they were saying exactly the same thing. So it turns out it was true. But it was unthinkable, just as for my grandfather in 1977, unthinkable that you would see the president of Egypt standing at attention for the Israeli national anthem. In June of 1981, that Begin the peacemaker will all of a sudden attack another Arab country seemed unthinkable, but of course it was completely in keeping with the principles that animated Begin's life, because Begin was always asking himself, what does the Jewish people now need? Now, Saddam had been building his nuclear reactor completely openly, without making any bones about it, with the help of the French, interestingly enough, ever since 1974. And it will remind you a little bit of the events that we've been seeing in the last few years. We're now in the summer of 2020 as we're having this conversation. But this summer and in previous years, this will remind you of that. In April of 1979, some core reactors were on their way to Iraq from France, and they were detonated, completely rendered useless. Some unheard of organization took responsibility for it, but nobody had any doubt that it was the Mossad. And then in June of 1980, an Egyptian nuclear scientist was killed. Everybody attributed it to the Mossad as well. So the clandestine attempt to stop Iraq from building its reactor had already started, but it's very eerily similar to today. It did not stop the work on the reactor. And Begin knew that he had to act, because if the reactor went live, went hot, then bombing the reactor would unleash huge amounts of radiation. And if Israel was going to bomb the reactor, it had to bomb the reactor before it was actually operative in order to make sure that lots and lots of people didn't get killed and that Israel didn't actually start a nuclear conflict. By October of 1980, Begin has approval from the cabinet. As long as an inner core of the cabinet agrees, they said, do what you need to do. Interestingly enough, it's very complicated and we can't go into it right now. Shimon Peres finds out about this. It's a long story. And Shimon Peres writes Begin a letter imploring him not to attack the reactor. This is the same thing like Chaim Weizmann imploring the Irgun and the Haganah not to bomb the King David Hotel building. The party of the left being so afraid of the military confrontation that even though in retrospect it was the right that knew what it needed to do, not always necessarily, and we'll see Begin make some very, very troubling decisions in 1982, but in this particular case, Peres was clearly wrong in light of history, but he wrote Begin this letter begging him not to do it. Begin knew that if Peres knew, other people knew, and it had to be put off because he was not going to endanger the pilots. Yair Shamir, who is the son of Yitzhak Shamir, happens to be one of the heads of the board of Shalem College, where we're having this conversation right now. And I talked to him about this when I was writing the book about Begin. And he told me that in those days, his father was part of that inner cabinet. He would become the next prime minister. But his father was part of the inner cabinet, whereas Yair, the son, was in the Israeli Air Force. And Yair told me his father would call him up periodically and ask him, you know, what kind of a plane could do this? How far could a plane like this go? How low would a plane have to fly in order to evade radar? His father couldn't say anything about why he was asking these questions. Of course, Yair knew because he was working on the actual plan of attack. So the father and the son are both working on the attack, one of them on the political level, one of them on the military level, and neither could actually tell the other that they knew what was going on, kind of just an indication of how secret the whole thing needed to be. There were eight pilots. We'll just mention two of them because they become very well known. One was Amos Yadlin, still very much alive, who would eventually become the head of Israel military intelligence. And the other was Ilan Ramon, who was in the eighth plane, therefore the most dangerous one because you're the last one in, the last one out, so they have more time to get their anti-aircraft fire working. He was unmarried. He was the one who was unmarried, and so he volunteered for the last plane, saying, if I get shot down, at least there's no widows or orphans. Thankfully, of course, it didn't come to be. He tragically died on February 1st, 2003, in the Columbia space shuttle disaster. As things are moving forward on June 7th, 1981, which is Erev Shavuot, it's a few hours before Shavuot, Yechiel Kadishai, who we've mentioned now several times, calls all the members of the cabinet and tells them to come to Begin's residence at 5 p.m. Each of them assumed that they had been invited individually, that Begin wanted to talk to them about something, which is a very great honor. So they were all thrilled to be invited Erev Shavuot to Begin's house at 5 o'clock. They didn't understand, of course, that everybody had been invited. But a few hours before that, Begin had been in his office with General Ephraim Poran, whose nickname was Froike. And the Mossad had brought Begin a whole series of psychological analyses of Saddam, basically asking, what's he going to do if this is successful? Are we going to have a war on our hands? How's the international community? And they told Begin to study this material, even though, of course, he'd seen it, to study it over and over again because some very pivotal decisions were going to have to get made. As Begin is poring over these documents in his office, Froike, this general, answers the phone, which had suddenly rung. He listens for a minute and then he hangs up and he tells Begin that the call was from General Rafael Eitan, telling him that he, Eitan, had just briefed the pilots, told them that the mission was a go, and he told them that if they failed, the state of Israel might not survive. At that point, Begin said, Hashem yishmor alehem, may God watch over them. He put the materials completely aside and said Yehuda Avner in his own memoirs about this. He had never seen Begin do this before, even though he was next to Begin virtually every day. Begin paced back and forth across the room, moving his lips silently. Avner was convinced till the very end of his days that Begin was reciting Psalms. In other words, you can study the materials from the Mossad a certain amount of time, but when those boys go up in the air, then you put the material from the Mossad aside, you say Hashem yishmor alehem, may God watch over them, and you say Psalms. About 40 minutes later, it's pretty quiet in the room. Begin is still walking back and forth. The phone rings a second time. Froike picks it up, and he relays to Begin, the planes are over the target. A couple minutes later, the phone rings a third time. Targets are completely destroyed. At 5 p.m., the entire cabinet shows up. They see each other there. They realize, okay, I was not invited to be here alone. Something is up, and they are told by Begin and Avner that the strike has taken place, the Iraqi nuclear reactor is destroyed, and they need to come up with a public announcement of what they're going to actually say. They wanted to come up with two different versions. The details don't matter right now. And Yehuda Avner reads out his draft of what he was proposing. And of course, it's a whole bunch of leaders of the Israeli government. It's clear that they're not going to all agree about it, about the language. And Yosef Burg, who was the head of the National Religious Party at that point, says the following. He says, first of all, we don't have to worry about doing this right now because Saddam is going to be humiliated. And if anything, he's going to try to deny that this happened altogether. And that proved very, very, very actually fortuitous because it's true that actually it was a foreign news agency that leaked the news of the attack. But more importantly, Burg said, look, it's Erev Shavuot. I have to go home. I have to have dinner. I'm teaching at a tikkun tonight. I'm not ready to teach yet. I've got to prepare. I don't have time for this right now. Which just is really a kind of extraordinary statement about what happens in the Israeli cabinet when they've just destroyed a nuclear reactor. One of the cabinet ministers can say, we have to talk about this in a couple of days. I have to prepare to teach Torah tonight at my synagogue. Needless to say, Israel breathed a huge sigh of relief, but the United States was livid. The New York Times, not surprisingly, called it an act of inexcusable and short-sighted aggression. Now, in response to this act of inexcusable and short-sighted aggression, Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, in June of 1991, when America, of course, had gone to war with Iraq, sent to David Ivry, who was one of the heads of the Air Force at that time, sent him a satellite photo of the destroyed reactor from back in the day when Israel had destroyed it 10 years earlier in 1981, with a long note basically saying, to you and to your fellow members of the Israeli Air Force, our thanks on behalf of the American Army for what you did, because if you had not done what you did, what we're doing in June 1991 would look entirely different. So it's actually a very interesting period in Begin's life. In the space of about 4 years, he goes from being elected to having this proposition made seemingly out of the blue, but not entirely, by Sadat, inviting Sadat, 2 years of really very intense negotiations, getting a Nobel Peace Prize, putting to bed the entire Israeli-Arab conflict, and then, of his own accord, initiating a very, very brief conflict with Iraq, destroying the nuclear reactor. Just end by noting two long-term ongoing implications of those actions taken by Begin. Number one, as I mentioned a little while ago, that peace with Egypt has held. There were times when Morsi came to office, not everybody was certain what's going to happen after there's a new Egyptian leader, but it held. Nobody has tried to stop it. It's not a hugely popular peace in Egypt. It's a very cold peace. Israelis don't walk around Cairo openly saying who they are very often. Sometimes they do, but usually they don't. But the peace has held and has made an enormous difference in Israel's strategic standing in the Middle East. And the other thing that's held, of course, is the Begin Doctrine. The Begin Doctrine is this new doctrine, which Begin started, which has it that no standing sworn enemy of the state of Israel will be ever allowed to acquire a weapon of mass destruction. Ehud Olmert invoked the Begin Doctrine when he destroyed a nuclear reactor outside of Damascus. And of course, Bibi implicitly invokes it all the time when he says that Iran will not be allowed to get a nuclear weapon no matter what. Bibi is just echoing what Menachem Begin said, that none of our sworn enemies can be allowed to get a weapon of mass destruction, because the whole point of the Jewish state was the safety and security and flourishing of the Jewish people, and anything that was going to undermine that in any way whatsoever was simply not going to be allowed to transpire. So thanks to Begin and this particular period that we've discussed, we have this period with this peace with Egypt, which has held for more than 40 years, the Begin Doctrine, which has held for almost 40 years, and time will tell if Israel is able to keep the Begin Doctrine in effect and to prevent Iran from doing what it was that Iraq had tried to do. And according to people who were on the plane with him, there was a room on the side that he had for himself, and he stayed in the room the entire time, and they could hear him crying from inside the room, "Lama azavti ota, lama azavti ota? Why did I leave her? Why did I leave her?"